Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is John Burns. John is the CEO of John Burns Real Estate Consulting Firm, located in Irvine. And I think maybe the best way to describe what he does is just to read what they say they do. We are a national source of independent housing research, advice, and consulting. Our mission is to help executives make informed housing industry decisions. Our firm provides builders, developers, banks, lenders, investors, and building product manufacturers with timely analysis. They need to make smart decisions quickly and cost effectively. Our research is backed by detailed data as well as proprietary tools and experienced professionals around the country. John, welcome back to our show.
Thanks, Bruce.
We kind of covered what we thought was going to happen in 2014, and you had mentioned that you thought it would turn out better than it did, and that's I thought that was reasonable. And we're both in a little bit of the same business that we try to look forward, and I try to tell myself where things are going to go, and then we have a group of people that listen, and you have a clientele that listens. I think all you can hope to do is, looking back a year later and looking at the same charts, you would have made the same exact projection. That gives me comfort going, okay, looking what I'm looking at, this is what I would have said, and I would have said it again. And the difference is now we look with one more year experience and look at it again and go, okay, since that didn't happen, what was the wild card we didn't figure on? And have you come up with any of those?
I'm still looking for it.
Okay.
I knew the investor was going to be pulling out. I mentioned their clients of mine. But I really thought, what I do not have a lot of visibility into, and you do, is a lot of the smaller professional investors, if you will. And I thought they would continue to fill the void. I picked up a couple of hard money lenders as clients, actually.
Okay.
And so I thought, and I knew they were lending to this group. And so I thought, heck, now there's debt for these people that have, you know, bought 20 homes. Now they can finance them at 50% and go buy another 20. And I don't understand why that didn't happen. Maybe you can fill me in.
Well, I think part of it is the ease of inventory changed. In other words, when you have, if you have a list of REOs, it's a lot easier to buy. Mm-hmm. If you have to find them one at a time, that's a much more difficult proposition. So you really had to have an experienced group of investors be able to understand that was a game. That was a game they were going to have to change on their own. That depletion of REOs ended some people's ability to buy because that's the only way they knew. When you get into a market that's like a 2013-14, and we're funding hard money loans, half of them are now coming directly from a seller via a mailer, from somebody that took the time to say, I buy houses, in the form of a mailer or a sign. So you really had to have somebody know that that transition was necessary. And that helps to being around it for 30 years to know that in advance. So, of course, I guess that's part of what we do is we teach our client that's coming, so go ahead and do it in advance. So that's why we still have a loan business. But I think that's part of it. I think the other thing is, maybe prices just rose in some areas where the cash flow wasn't there.
Right.
And, you know, that's an interesting thing. When I look at, and you're more familiar with this than I am, but as far as the construction numbers in California, single family construction is still at a depression level and has been for 6 years. I remember adding up the last 6 years of construction on single families, and it's less than 1 year in 1962, which is the earliest year I have. So that's pretty bad. But what's interesting is also, if I look at subdivision creation going forward, we're still down in Riverside County about 85% from a normal year. And that speaks to somebody's confidence going forward. So you're a consultant for these companies. What do they see going forward that really concerns them?
There are a couple things in there. One thing that didn't change during the downturn was the cost to develop a lot. Maybe some of the horizontal construction costs fell, but the entitlement fees went up. And what's keeping subdivision construction down is really financial feasibility. The builders would be creating more lots and building more homes if they could make money doing so, and they just haven't been able to. And during the downturn, of course, there's no money devoted to entitlements either, so that was part of the problem. But during the downturn, there were a lot of environmental restrictions that got added and new fees that came on, and it just really made it very difficult to build a home these days.
But if you look at subdivision creation in Riverside County in 05 and 06, it's just, it keeps on going up. So a developer in 2005 and 06 that developed subdivisions at a record pace, at least for that era, were they counting on future price increases to make that work? And they were they were in the middle of a great market.
They were in the middle of a great market, and at the end game was to sell a $500,000 house. Well, now that house is $300,000. And guess what? It doesn't make any financial sense at all to develop that lot. So they're not developing it.
How did the FHA's reduction of loan balance affect the builders?
It hurt them pretty hard, but we just pulled some data that stunned me a little bit. So the FHA reduction cut right across the swath of where new homes were priced. In Riverside, for example, it went from about $500,000 down to about $350,000, and most of the new homes were priced between $500,000 and $350,000. So it took the low down payment buyers out of the equation altogether. I was surprised, though, Bruce. We went back and bought the data for this year through October,
mm-hmm.
I think it was, or maybe through up September. There's been as many transactions between 350 and 500 this year as last year.
Interesting.
So there's been just as much activity in the market. What's fallen is the below 350, and I think it goes to what you were saying, just the lack of supply in the lower priced homes.
Okay.
The builders had a tough year in all price points, and they're pointing to that as certainly one of the reasons.
Do you guys do any research on, let's say, the amount of unsold inventory going into a year versus, sales? This has got to be maybe the lowest ever as far as inventory that's unsold going into a year.
The months of supply?
Yeah, months of supply of new homes or just the actual numbers. It seems like there's just no overhang of new homes.
No, you're right. And there's not much home. There's not a big overhang of resale homes either.
Yeah, that's interesting. And going forward, there was always some concern there's going to be this big glut of inventory. And I look out and go, okay, well, how does that occur when you've now got 91% of sellers, equity sellers,
right,
to buy something? So it's very hard to go up in inventory, which is, going back to one of the things that would, for me, to point to a 2014 and say this could be a very strong year. Part of that was that those 91% of sellers would buy something and there would be less and less available. So the fact that volume of sales was down on existing homes, that surprised me a lot. It really did.
Yeah, me too.
So now you go to the lending world. So what do you feel the impact of not just the, let's say, FHA changing a loan balance, but the people that they're incapable of saying yes to that in a normal market they would? Is that, do you think, where the problem lies?
Yes. And what you're referring to really is the reps and warranties issue. So the documentation, the mortgage guys describe it to me, they have to build the perfect loan file. Because what they learned this time is that if you went into default, somebody would go through the loan file and say, hey, you forgot to dot this I and cross this T, and force a whole bunch of banks fines and put back the principal to the underwriter. So the banks have said, boy, if you're going to do that to me, I need to build the perfect credit file here. And they may come up with somebody who clearly can pay the loan, but they've got an outstanding medical bill that's pretty explicable, or, hey, they were... their income was lower 2 years ago because their wife stopped working when they had a child and now she's back in the workforce. All these reasons that are very reasonable the banks are concerned that if the loan goes into default, that the government will put it back to them and say, hey, you shouldn't have loaned to this person. They didn't have 3 years' worth of income. And it's the automated underwriting. And it goes to these reps and warranties. The banks are not, it has not been made clear, although apparently there's some clarity made 2 weeks ago, what is reasonable underwriting and what is not in that regard. So the banks have gotten very conservative. Some of the non-banks tend to be a little bit more aggressive and can see the forest through the trees, but they're charging more of a premium interest rate, if you will, for that.
Okay. And so you're talking about overlays, basically, that FHA or Fannie say they'll buy a certain loan, but then the person that actually writes it goes, there's no way I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Or, you know, I'll do it if I know that person has 6 months of reserves in the bank. That's a sample overlay.
Right.
So the bank's saying, okay, I'm going to take this putback risk, but I need something else that makes me feel good that I'm not going to, this isn't going to be a bad loan, and that's what they've been doing.
What do you think the impact of the 3% Fannie and Freddie new loan program, 3% down, what do you think that's going to have as far as impact?
Well, it's going to take some market share from FHA.
Right. Will it add sales?
It'll add some, but everything we've looked at and everything we've been told is it's not going to be monumental. What it is doing is it's shifting some risk from FHA, which charged a pretty hefty insurance premium, to the GSEs, which charge less of a premium.
Correct. So that, but it also isn't made for the same borrower, right? Fannie's credit requirement would be higher than FHA's.
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So, yeah, I didn't see that as a blockbuster. Oh, boy, here we go. We're going to have a lot of volume.
Well, you know what it is, though? It's symptomatic to me of a shift in Wall Street from, hey, let's protect the consumer from themselves and come up with all these ridiculous rules to make sure that we don't make loans to people who can't afford them, to now things are starting to loosen up, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, several years from now, we get back to some pretty loose lending again.
That would make perfect sense because that seems to be, first of all, human nature, which I usually count on when I look at charts.
Right.
And it's also the practical direction from where we are.
Well, and I think politicians want to grow homeownership in this country. And it's been pushed pretty, you know, and don't underestimate the power of the real estate lobbyists. I've been told they're the most powerful group in Washington, D.C., and if this is the right thing for them, there's a pretty good chance it's going to get done.
Okay. What about the group that were former owners? And I know you've done some research on this. California, record number of foreclosures, record number of loan mods and so forth. But the people that actually got foreclosed on, if you added them up in Riverside County, they literally were more than a year's worth of volume of sales. So their reemergence, I thought, would be on top of normal demand and drive demand through the roof, and that didn't happen. So the inclination of the person that got foreclosed on 5 years ago, is it, I don't like ownership, or I'd like a chance to own, but I haven't been able to get a yes answer?
Yeah, I think there's some of both. We did a white paper on that, too, projecting the recovery of the boomerang buyer, and actually in 2012, I think we got it pretty darn close, and then even 2013, but they disappeared in 2014. So I think what happened was the ones who really wanted to get back in did, and then now we're sitting there with everybody else. I was in Phoenix last week where Mike Orr, who's one of the top guys there from ASU, had figured out that 26% of all the homes in Phoenix have gone through foreclosure.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
No.
And I was at a real estate conference where this guy goes, I know 90% of the people in this room, and half of them went through foreclosure. And there's a bad taste in everybody's mouth, and plus they still got bad credit. And what I've also learned from talking to the mortgage guys is, you know, when you lose your job, it creates a lot of other issues. It's not only you went through foreclosure, but you've got outstanding liens and medical bills and credit cards and all sorts of things you ended up defaulting on that really make you very hard to underwrite.
Yeah, that is, that's true, if it's not just related to I just quit my payment and just stay there for a few years.
Yeah, and there's one other thing that I've really clued into lately is there is a replacement product out there for them called the single-family rental homes.
Yeah.
And, you know, everyone talks about them as comparing them to apartments, it really the tenant profile is really your homeowner profile. It's somebody with two kids and a dog. And they've got a home, they can afford the payment, they've got the flexibility, they're in the school district they want to be in. What's the hurry?
Well, that's a great question, because usually the hurry would be it's economically very profitable to own one, but their recent experience was it was devastating.
Yeah, and I also think there's been a sea change, particularly amongst the younger people who weren't in this time around or last time, and are saying, you know, I shouldn't leverage myself to the eyeballs. In fact, I'm not going to take on a mortgage until I've got 6 months of reserves. And that just takes a lot of time to save that kind of money.
Okay, so that the millennial generation, what's interesting about that group, because I've had to do some studying about that, and you've had some research that was sent to me that was very helpful on college debt, but a lot of them don't even have full-time jobs yet.
Right.
So they obviously, there's no way they're going to qualify for buying a house until then, but they're also just an unusual generation in that they're making households much later, or a different type of household. It's a one-person household.
Yeah, so I'll spin it a little differently. What was unusual was the baby boomers.
Okay.
I think it is, if you look around the rest of the world, and if you look around the United States before the baby boomers, you lived with your parents until you got married or had a kid. And, I mean, that was common. I mean, people live in a lot of countries, it's considered insulting to move out, you know, until you get married. So I, you know, us baby boomers look at them and say, boy, this is really unusual. It's actually, I think, more usual. And when you throw on top of it, you ask the baby boomers, you know, did you raise the kids to get along with them and to be able to keep them in the house in their 20s? The answer is usually yes. And they get along. And so I want to change the paradigm from, you know, these people are slackers, they won't get out of the house, to more, hey, I'm living with mom and dad because it's financially smart. Why would I pay somebody rent?
And I suppose, and I think this was mentioned by Doug Duncan on the meeting that we had, was that some of it is at the request of the parents because it's helpful to the household.
Absolutely. Lennar, you know, there's some real exciting things going on in the home building industry that are more opportunistic. And Lennar's next-gen models are multi-generational homes, so it's a brand new home design with separate entries and separate living space for an adult kid or your parents, where they can be part of the house but really go peel off and be something separate. Those type of homes don't exist in the resale market, and they've done very well with those.
That makes sense. It just occurred to me when we were talking, and you mentioned judicial foreclosure states as far as lagging. When you get foreclosed on in California, they take the house. That's the end of that. But when you lose a house in a judicial state, there's a judgment. So will the recovery in those types of markets be much slower or very different?
Because you're not put in the same bucket, and your FICO's trashed.
No, your FICO score maybe is trashed equally as long, but you have no chance of a judgment in California that's recorded, where in a judicial state, that process probably allows for that.
Yeah, you're more of an expert there than I am.
Okay, but anyway, I think that might be worth looking at, because those people, once they're foreclosed on, might have, okay, we lost $100,000 on your house, and now there's a judgment against you. They might just become renters for a long time.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, and especially if they, here in California, if you refied, you could have a judgment against you.
Yeah, but they'd have to do a judicial foreclosure, which they don't. So that's,
I've heard there's very few people pursuing that money because those people don't have money in the first place. But it doesn't surprise me that could be an issue.
Yeah, well, in California, they didn't pursue it because of what you just said. In Florida, I guess it's part and parcel with the process that they'll have one. So we'll see.
Yeah, I heard there's some companies actually that will buy that judgment from the bank
for nothing.
Don't like for you know, penny. On the dollar.
Exactly.
And then go after you.
Yeah, so, at some point in the future, that type of thing. All right, enough of that. Hope they don't. What the heck? Not worth it. Baby boomer habits. I'm just curious. I'm one of them. What percentage of time do they retire and just move completely out of an area? Is that very uncommon?
Yeah, it's very uncommon. Well, it's much more common in the East Coast because of the weather. You do see people getting the heck out of the Northeast and the Midwest and going to Florida and the Carolinas.
Okay.
I think it's less common in the Western U.S. And I think the number one amenity for baby boomers in retirement is their grandchildren.
Exactly.
So if the kids have moved to Phoenix to get a job, guess who's going to Phoenix?
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Do they generally want to downsize? Or do they mind just staying where they're at?
Most people prefer to stay where they're at because they're comfortable there. There's no transaction costs. By far, the mobility rate just goes down and down and down as people get older. Those that move, though, are looking for a floor plan that tends to be more livable.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're currently in a house with a lot of stairs or maybe a big yard to mow, they'll be looking for a single-story home with, rocks in the backyard as landscape.
Okay. Key charts. What are your charts where you look at and say, okay, that's very positive, or ones where you go, well, that would concern me?
We put out a huge macro national report every single month. It's almost 300 pages now, a page for every variable. And I got to tell you, most of them look fine. There's maybe about 7 or 8 that show, hey, we still haven't fully recovered yet. The capacity in the plants is still not at norm. You mentioned the job growth being part-time instead of full-time. There's a number of things that are a reminder that, we still have, this was such a nasty downturn, we still haven't completely recovered. And then the one that puzzles me a little bit, and maybe it's because of all those things, is consumer confidence really has not come back. It's back to its historical averages, if you will, in most of the confidence measures we look at. And income growth is not occurring, but we're starting to tear that one up quite a bit. And I think there's some more positive news on the income side than people think. But we could do a whole hour on that one.
Okay. I hear this word, prices are getting frothy, and most of the time it comes from a source I really don't believe. But do you feel there are markets that are currently pushing their limits to where they're in danger of anything negative?
San Francisco seems really frothy to me.
Yeah.
But, and I just did a big event up there with Pacific Union Homes, which was fascinating. They broadcast it to a couple places in China live.
That makes perfect sense.
It does, but that was scary enough in and of itself, right? That tells you what's going on, that we're broadcasting local housing market back to China. What I struggle with there was, by historical standards, even by San Francisco's expensive historical standards, this is too expensive. But then you talk to these investor groups and you go, well, why is San Francisco cheaper than London and cheaper than Paris and cheaper than New York and cheaper than Hong Kong and Shanghai? And you scratch your head and go, shouldn't it be at least as expensive? And that's the upside that they may be going through. That's the bullish case. But San Francisco still concerns, because I don't think the incomes of the local people
exactly
support what's going on.
Yeah, that is not your replacement buyer for what's going on. There is no way.
Right, but you could have said that about Manhattan every year for the last 40 years.
And you know what? That's important to realize, that there are very unique situations that you get paid very well for speculating.
Right.
And that's one of them, that's for sure. We got about 40 seconds left. Any tax law changes that you see coming that might hurt real estate? Prop 13?
No. Do you?
No, I really don't. I think that's like the third rail. At least I hope so. I don't see any point in that. Okay, so for 2015...
Well, actually, I do one. It already happened.
Okay.
The tax increase in the state of California, the income tax increase,
yes,
clearly drove some affluent people to Nevada. Because we've been doing work in Nevada, and we've seen million-dollar homes transacting in Las Vegas to people from California.
That makes sense. John, we got to go. Thanks so much for your time. We really, really enjoyed our meeting.
My pleasure, Bruce.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.